The fourth case on today's oral argument calendar is number A18-1104, in re the marriage of Nelson versus Nelson. As counsel knows, each of you has 15 minutes for your initial arguments, and appellant's counsel will have an opportunity for rebuttal. You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, I'm Elizabeth Kadem, counsel for appellant Jeffrey Nelson. We're here today to ask the court to reverse the district court's decisions as to two assets that were awarded to Mr. Nelson in the marriage dissolution following a five-day trial. Those assets were related to two businesses that I will refer to as Business 1 and Business 2. The first business, for the record, is S&B Geothermal Incorporated. The second is SB Mechanical Geothermal Inc., and that one is Business 2. That's consistent with the party's briefs. We're also asking for reversal on attorney's fees, which is largely grounded in findings related to those businesses. The district court found that the parties owned an asset related to the first business, valued at $50,000, and valued the party's interest in the second business at $20,000. It awarded both of those assets to Mr. Nelson alone at those values, and the record simply doesn't support either valuation or award. In a marriage dissolution matter, assets have to be valued based upon their fair market value, and that did not occur here for a myriad of reasons. As to business one, the chief reason why the district court's award was erroneous is that business one had declared bankruptcy and had been liquidated long before the valuation date or initiation of this dissolution, which was very late August 2016. Business one had ceased to exist. There was no value there, and nothing is left. But for a business in Chapter 7 bankruptcy.
So you make that argument to us, but in the record below, both in the briefing and at oral arguments, I didn't see that you made that argument to the district court that by virtue of Chapter 7 bankruptcy that the company would have no value. Did you? Can you point me to the record where you did make those arguments?
Well, certainly Mr. Nelson in his testimony described any purported investment that would be in business one as non-existent because that business had gone bankrupt. And if I recall correctly, the proposed findings from Mr. Nelson's attorney at the time did not include value for business one. That came solely from the proposal from the petitioner. And in fact, as we point out in our brief, those valuations were precisely the same as proposed by petitioner, the $50,000.
And then did you raise this issue in a timely post-trial motion for amended findings or a new trial?
As we noted in the brief, there was a motion that was deemed untimely, but that's not necessary to question the finding or the conclusion as to those assets. That is still fair game for appeal, and there's no limitation.
Let's talk about that a little bit. You said that the argument was made in his testimony, in your client's testimony. But the district court did not find that to be credible.
The district court did not dispute that, quote, business one had not declared bankruptcy or anything of that nature. The district court didn't say, I don't find it incredible that it didn't, you know, declare bankruptcy. What it did was recognize a, quote, investment in the amount of $50,000, did not make any effort as to value any.
Here's the struggle I'm having, because okay. The district court found your client not to be credible in many respects. And one of those respects was as to the valuation.
Correct.
So I'm looking at this, and how do I find error in that?
The credibility determinations weren't made as sometimes is done by the district court by noticing someone's disposition, et cetera. It was grounded on a misapprehension of what needed to be disclosed and the law, from what we can tell, based on the judgment and decree language. It's conflating a business that had gone bankrupt with a successor business that purchased the assets out of bankruptcy, which you can't do. It is valuing an asset based on purported investment that you can't do. You need to value an asset based on its fair market value at the time of the valuation date. It doesn't matter what they put into it and, you know, potentially, unfortunately, lost, which is what happened here if it was indeed an investment. But even that is fundamentally flawed because the record shows quite clearly that this wasn't an investment that the parties made. These were loan infusions.
That's not what the district court found, though.
Correct. And it was, again, faulty reasoning that this court has the ability to overturn because these are clearly erroneous findings.
But then we have to disregard the credibility determination the district court made as to whether it's an investment or not. And how do we get around that?
I don't believe that's a credibility determination. I believe that is a legal determination that was a misapprehension of the facts on the record and the law as to how these assets are valued.
Misapprehension and misinterpretation are two different things. Are you saying it's a misapprehension? Because that would be in the discretion of the court. If it was a misinterpretation of the law, that's a separate thing.
Misinterpretation, correct. Okay. And I apologize if I misspoke there.
I didn't see that the record contained any expert testimony valuing the businesses. Can you point me to some place in the record where there is expert testimony?
Mr. Nelson did testify briefly, and parties can do that. He's got a background as a CPA and testified briefly about business valuation. Ms. Nelson did not present any expert testimony on that. That's true. However, Mr. Nelson would have had no reason to try to value a business that was defunct, had gone bankrupt.
So and, you cite to the Nardini case?
Correct.
And I'm wondering where you asked the judge or pointed to factors, Nardini factors, for the district court to consider.
Nardini stands for the proposition that you have to value a business at its fair market value. You have to look at things like book value, assets, and debts. You can use another approach, capitalization, cash flow, projected incomes. None of that could occur, quite frankly, with Business One. And the fact that you really can't apply Nardini to a defunct bankrupt business is very telling. So it's the district court, had they attempted to go through a Nardini analysis, would have seen quite clearly that so Business One has no assets because it's bankrupt.
Confuse them because you cite Nardini to us.
Correct.
So you're just saying there's no way that it could be applied to Business One. So what are you asking us to do?
It is an odd situation because you've got a district court valuing a business that doesn't exist. And if you are going to value a business, you have to look to these things. And the idea is that you can't because the business is bankrupt and the district court did not recognize the law and just that reality.
Well, getting back to what Judge Smith had to say, isn't that because the district court found your client and his business partner, who testified about Business One having no value, found both of them to be not credible, and that your client had tried to hide his investment in Business One from respondent entirely?
Am I reading the order wrong? I understand that the district court found that there was some concealment. But that is essentially irrelevant to a valuation question in the end. So any credibility determination in that for those small facts really doesn't have anything to do with the assessment of how this should have gone on the balance sheet. It goes on as an asset. And in order to put an asset on a balance sheet, you have, especially a business asset, you have to find a fair market value. So there isn't any finding of the district court that says, for instance, that 518.58 applies, and that's brought up by the respondent in their brief as a potential basis for this. This case does not involve any sort of concealment in contemplation of the dissolution or during the dissolution. All of these alleged investments occurred from, at the latest, 2015, but the only solid evidence that we have is back in 2013. This marriage dissolution wasn't commenced until late August 2016. So that statute is not applicable, just on its face. And this unfortunately happens in marriages all the time, maybe, where somebody isn't quite paying enough attention. Now, all of these alleged infusions into Business One, and there is no evidence of infusions into Business Two, but all of them came from a joint bank account. So any question about concealment really isn't relevant to the valuation. That's the bottom line there. It's not relevant to anything in contemplation of marriage, and I don't believe that there is any law that makes it relevant at the point of valuation. So while the district court may have made some credibility calls about, you know, what husband was doing, that isn't relevant at this point. It is very important that...
Am I correct that yes. The district court did not find dissipation?
I did not see anything of that nature in the district court's judgment and decree. And the fact that it puts these businesses on the balance sheet as assets, I mean, right at the top of the table there, it says asset distribution, and values them as business interests, really negates any possibility that they're talking about a dissipation. Of assets. I certainly wouldn't deny that the district court would have the ability to do equity broadly. However, it found business interests that the record simply doesn't support. The fact that these were loan infusions, which the record very clearly supports through this register of the note payable and the promissory note on the second loan infusion, is vitally important in this case, because we had a situation where Business One had been paying Mr. Nelson back steadily, and money went back into the marital estate to the point of about $1,000 being owed at the time that bankruptcy was declared.
You said it was important, but you said it wasn't important because the only consideration was fair market value. So loan infusion shouldn't make any difference, right?
Fair market value of any alleged investment. So,
well, but if it's bankrupt and it doesn't have any value, then the investment doesn't make any difference, does it?
Correct. So that would be scenario one if you're going to consider it to be an investment. But in reality, when you look at the evidence, these were loan infusions and that were paid back. So that would be.
But what difference does that make if the only consideration is fair market value?
I think it is a bit six of one, half of dozen of the other, but either way, you end up with $0 as to Business One. So it's kind of the other route, and I think this is what the record actually reflects, and it's very important to see that. If anything, Mr. Nelson and Ms. Nelson were a creditor of Business One at the time that... the bankruptcy was declared, a small creditor, an unsecured creditor. I think we have no reason to believe that this was secured in any way. And that basically dissolved as in the bankruptcy. And then we move on to initiation of Business Two, which The district court appears to have found to be valued at $20,000. The testimony from Ms. Tempty that they had had an offer to purchase that business for $20,000 is what that appears to be based on. Of course, that is clearly erroneous to be putting $20,000 on the balance sheet because Mr. Nelson owned only 51% of that business. So even if you assume that you can value the business at $20,000 despite the debts that exceed that, you shouldn't be putting it on the balance sheet at $20,000. So that appears to be an obvious error, potentially a math error, but again, it reflects those findings that were provided by the respondent.
Thank you, Ms. Kadem. You will have an opportunity for rebuttal. Counsel for respondent.
May it please the court, my name is Beverly Dodge. I represent the respondent, Sharon Nelson. I think it's important, and judging from the court's questions, I think you find it important also that Judge Gibbs conducted 5 days of trial spread over a 3-month period of time on the issues related to this dissolution and made finding after finding after finding about Mr. Nelson's conduct in complicating the divorce proceeding by his failure to disclose pertinent information through the course of discovery, through the course of trial, which continued through the end of trial. This trial was commenced in August of 2016. We got to trial a year and a half later. During the course of discovery, none of the information from which we could hire an expert and have this business interest valued was provided by Mr. Nelson. He continued to insist that there was no investment in these businesses, that they had no value, that business number one was bankrupt, business number two had ceased operations. It wasn't until after the second day of trial when the trial court ordered Mr. Nelson to allow Ms. Nelson into the marital homestead to retrieve her personal belongings, that Ms. Nelson discovered the hidden balance sheets, profit and loss statements, business plans that opened the door to the third day of trial, at which, for the first time, he produces this ledger from which we were able to determine that the investments into business one that occurred in 2013 were made from the party's checking account. That triggered the ready reserve line or the home equity loan line to cover the investments. And that's the same mortgage that Ms. Nelson is paying right now. The ledger also provided us with the timing of those investments, especially the last investment, which was $9,000 that not coincidentally occurred on the exact same day that Business One filed bankruptcy. Business One files bankruptcy. He contributes another $9,000 that, again, not coincidentally, brings the total investment to $50,000, and a week later acquires a 51% ownership interest in this business that has been in existence for 30-some years, a multi-million dollar business revenue-wise. The timing of all of that, in conjunction with Mr. Nelson's hiding of this evidence, not coming out until the third day of trial, is what led Judge Gibbs to believe that he was not credible.
Let's talk about valuation, though. How do we know the value of the business? It isn't what is invested, but it is the fair market value, isn't
it? We don't know the value of the business, and we don't know the value of the business because the person who had sole possession of the information from which we could determine the value didn't produce the information during discovery or even during the trial.
Well, how could you make an accurate determination of the value without that information?
It is the position of the trial court, as expressed through the findings, that that $50,000 investment was what purchased Mr. Nelson's interest in business number two.
After the bankruptcy?
Yes. The bankruptcy was filed October 14th. 1 week later, the new business, number two, is incorporated. Same customers, same equipment. In fact, there was testimony at trial that business number two was created to purchase the assets of business number one.
Okay, so you're saying that the, and I want to make sure I'm following your argument here, is that the investment was $41,000 plus the nine, and that's how you determine the value of the business. And that's the fair market value because that's what was invested.
That was the fair market value of business number one that rolled over into business number two, and then they proceeded to operate business number two for quite a long period of time, although they claim not. In the first 2 months of operation, they had several hundred thousand dollars in receipts. I mean, to the tune of, I think the reply brief even categorizes it as $600,000 in receipts. I might be wrong about that number. But clearly, they moved six open jobs from business one to business two. And then there were 14 jobs just in the first 2 months of operation in business two. That's all the information that we got from the business plan, profit and loss statement, the business plan, those documents that Ms. Nelson located on top of her shoe cabinet.
And all of that occurred before the petition for dissolution?
Yes, 10 months before.
So would it be more accurate to say then that business two is worth 50 or perhaps 70 and business one is worth zero?
Judge Gibbs could have done it that way. That's true. But that doesn't really make a difference, does it, in the overall valuation of his involvement with these businesses at $70,000?
Or maybe it's zero and 20, I guess. But it is difficult to understand how a business that has been liquidated in a bankruptcy proceeding has any value at all.
The findings indicate that Judge Gibbs was concerned about the fact that the $50,000 investment triggered the home equity line of credit and was then converted over into a mortgage, which my client continues to pay. So the marital estate was harmed by that $50,000 investment that, if in fact...
Well, district court could always allocate the debt in a different way. But if we're focusing on the value of these two businesses, it seems like what you're describing is that there was value in business one at some time. The value was transferred to business two, effectively.
I think that that's accurate. And I would say that business two, if you follow Judge Gibbs's logic, business two probably is still in some form still in existence. There was no evidence provided that it is bankrupt or that it has no value or that it has ceased operations. It still has a ongoing website. It still has an ongoing phone number. It still has at least Ms. Tempty as an employee. All of that information is part of the record from which I believe Judge Gibbs determined that whatever value either business has, it's an ongoing value to Mr. Nelson.
What was the date of valuation in this case?
I don't believe we ever agreed on a date of valuation, and Judge Gibbs determined a couple different valuation dates. For instance, with regard to the bank accounts, he chose the date of separation as opposed to the date of the pretrial because there was some manipulation of those accounts in between the date that the divorce was filed and the date of the initially scheduled pre-hearing conference.
Isn't it presumed that the date of valuation is the date of the pretrial generally?
In many respects, yes, and oftentimes. But oftentimes courts choose to use different dates.
If they use a different date, don't they have to indicate which date they're using?
Your Honor, the first pretrial in this matter was April of 2017. So this is a case that went on for a long time. The parties spent four sessions in F, E, and E, and then a fifth session with the same F, E, and E facilitator. They had two pretrials and one moderated settlement conference, and then 5 days of trial. So over the course of this year and a half, there was ample opportunity for Mr. Nelson to provide the information from which we could fully develop what was necessary to present at trial. We did hire an expert. We hired Carol Devitt of Baker Tilly. But when it came right down to it, by the start of the first day of trial, she says, I don't have anything. You haven't given me anything that from which I can put a value on these business interests. And it wasn't until after day two that we discovered the profit and loss statement from December of 2015, by the way, that Mr. Nelson, the Masters of Business Administration and a certified public accountant and a 51% owner of this business too, says he doesn't know who did this balance sheet that we found in his house on top of the shoe cabinet. Doesn't know who created it. But that balance sheet gave us the information we needed to move forward with day three, at which time this ledger was produced. All in all, it is abundantly clear that it was Mr. Nelson who made it difficult for Judge Gibbs to make a determination as to what value to assess to this business involvement. And so whether Judge Gibbs said 50,000 business one, 20,000 business two, or said 70,000 for business two, or said, I don't know what the value of the business is, but I do know that Ms. Nelson's paying down the mortgage that was created because of this investment, or that because he hid his involvement with these businesses, we're going to give Ms. Nelson a larger part of the marital estate. Could have done any one of those things, and it would all have been supported by the evidence. What isn't supported by the evidence, and what the appellate court shouldn't do, is to second-guess what he did do, because he had all sorts of options for doing all those things.
Well, here's the problem I'm having, is that we didn't even know the date of valuation.
We do not. With respect to the businesses, we do not.
So
the first pretrial was on, as I said, April 2017.
So isn't that an essential finding that we need?
Not if you consider the evidence that was introduced at trial and that the court considered with regard to the concealment of his involvement in these businesses.
I understand that, but how do we know at what point it was valued, whether it was the date of the dissolution or the date of the pretrial or some point in between?
We don't know. We don't know because he didn't produce the information that would have allowed us to do that. We don't know what these businesses are really worth or were really worth at any given time because none of that information was produced until after the third day of trial.
Well, that's not what the district court said, right? The district court made findings.
Did make findings about the values attributable to the businesses based on, I believe Ms. Kadem is correct, the $50,000 is with regard to the investment that the court believes unduly depleted the marital estate and resulted in this debt that my client is paying. That's that $50,000. And I think the $20,000 was based on the offer to purchase the business. Frankly, I think Judge Gibbs could have found a much higher value for that second business and was highly restrained in saying it was only worth $20,000.
I mean, isn't it true that married couples, you know, if they are investing in a business, if they're investing marital funds, they invest together and they're each they each receive the benefits or the detriments of that investment, right?
Well, I think Ms. Kadem conflates apathy during a marriage in finding out what's going on. She implied that Ms. Nelson perhaps was not paying attention as opposed to there being active concealment. With the active concealment of that investment, not only during the marriage and up to the 10 months prior to her commencement of the divorce action, with his active concealment of it throughout the divorce proceeding as well.
Well, I guess I was referring to the investments that were made in Business One, the capital contributions apparently of $50,000. I mean, it sounds almost like in the nature of dissipation, like the district court was blaming him for misusing marital funds, which turned out to, you know, to be a loss, a total loss.
I think there is a component of that, and there is a finding.
But is that logical? Is that, I mean, that's, I mean, what case law says that that's a legitimate way to value a business? You know, I mean, that it's logical to have, if we know that the that capital contributions of $50,000 were made, but the business is presently worth zero, isn't the district court, I mean, if that's what we know, isn't the district court bound to make a finding of zero?
I don't think that the court believed that Business One was worth zero. I believe that the court believed that it was worth a minimum of $50,000, and that's how he acquired his interest in Business Two.
But
because there's no explanation for why this man of who had run this business for 30 years would just turn over a 51% ownership interest in this business to Mr. Nelson.
Okay, and I guess going back to Judge Smith's question, so that, I'll call it a sort of a, in a sense, a transfer of value from Business One to Business Two. Do we know when that occurred vis-a-vis the valuation date?
And well, I guess you said the transfer occurred on October, a week after October 14th, 2015. 10 months later is when Ms. Nelson commenced the divorce action. So the bankruptcy, the official bankruptcy filing was October 14th. That was when the $9,000 was withdrawn from the checking account to bring the total investment to $50,000. 1 week later, the Business 2 was incorporated with Mr. Nelson as the 51% owner and the former receptionist of this business as a 49% owner. Neither, both of whom claim we didn't invest any money, which flies in the face of the profit and loss statement that we discovered on top of the shoe cabinet, with a considerable amount of assets and income in the first 2 months of operation. I see my time is up.
Thank you, Ms. Dodge. Ms. Kadem, you have an opportunity for rebuttal.
Thank you. On the issue of disclosure.
Could I ask one thing before you start?
I'm sorry.
What are you asking us to do? To send the entire case back for further proceedings with the district court?
We're asking you to reverse the findings as to valuation for Business One and Business
but
Two.
But doesn't that
entirely
require us to send the whole case back and have the court reevaluate everything? Because
I don't believe so. I think that you can make those findings based on the record that's presented. They've gone through 5 days of trial, and there was misapplication of the law here. Business One should have had no value recognized whatsoever. That should be determined by this court as valued at zero. And
but if we do that, then doesn't that change the entire structure of the findings as to what each person is getting?
All that would be necessary is just an adjustment of that equalizer payment, and the math is $35,000. So the court recognized $70,000 in assets that it shouldn't have, and Ms. Nelson should be paying Mr. Nelson $35,000 more in the equalizer as an as a
but
result.
But if we remand it, then the district court has to make a determination of what the actual value is.
And enter that that judgment, yes, but I think
And wouldn't that change the entire?
I think this court can determine that those businesses should have been valued at zero.
But we can't make findings. The district court would have to do that.
I think you can find the recognition of those as having any value as clearly erroneous and okay. Indicate that and
careful
remand
for
findings accordingly. I do think that you can do that. On the issue of disclosure, which is extremely important in this matter, there was no reason to disclose Business One. It had gone through bankruptcy. All Mr. Nelson was potentially a small creditor there by the time the dissolution started. Business Two was disclosed immediately in the answer and counter petition. excuse me, it is very clear from the record, based on respondents' own exhibits, that they had plenty of information about what was going on with Business 2. They have the tax returns from 2015 for Business 2 labeled as their Exhibit 24, in which the business shows negative taxable income of $6,200. That is a final tax return that was submitted to the IRS. Much more reliable than a preliminary document that was used for a shareholder meeting earlier in December, certainly. They have, labeled as their Exhibit 17, a profit and loss statement for Business 2 for the period of January to December 2016, including lots of detail and annotation by them. They've got a balance sheet as of the end of 2016, all before the valuation date under the statute in April 2017. They have a profit and loss statement for even Business 1 labeled as their Exhibit 25. These are all in the addendum. The fact that she found some preliminary documents and some notes from a shareholder meeting on top of a cabinet in the midst of trial does not mean that they didn't have the ability to value this business through their expert that they had hired. They have financials for this business. They have tax returns from the exact same time period that they're saying, oh, we discovered this new information from December 2015, which is not the critical time period, as you noted. We have on the record Ms. Tempty saying Business 2 isn't operating as of January 2017. They're failing in 2016. There's no evidence that disputes that. Mr. Nelson is not getting ongoing income from this business. It's not functioning. Ms. Tempty is infusing $3,000 or $4,000 here to try to keep it alive and get it sold because the business has debts and they want to cover these debts, including $18,000 to the IRS, which is not going away. So it is completely unfathomable to me that you couldn't have an expert value this business with detailed financials that were disclosed. I think it's very telling that they say that these things should have been produced in discovery, that, you know, he was concealing, and they have not identified a single discovery request that wasn't answered. They haven't talked about how, you know, he was deposed and didn't disclose something, or he lied in a deposition. He was giving them financials for this business, and he and Ms. Tempty were very forthcoming that this was a defunct business and it had a bunch of debts. They could maybe sell it for $20,000 but would still have to pay. And therefore, the court should find that the record shows clearly that there's no value for either business. Thank you.
Thank you to counsel for your arguments. The case is submitted. The court will issue its opinion within 90 days.